All right. Hello, everybody. Let me get the microphone on here, too. Trying to get all the notes down today because there's a lot to cover. We are continuing our study, The Visions of God. We are now opening our study into the final book of the Bible, the book of Revelation. And everybody should have an outline, a little notepad, and every family ought to have a CD. So the CDs, if you don't, there's more up here. Thank you, Art. The CDs are Alexander Scorby reading the book of Revelation, the King James Version. The reason I made copies of those for everybody is it's probably one of the best readings. He's one of the best narrators of the Bible in audio Bible terms. And he does such an excellent job of reading it that it really paints the picture when you listen to it. And what I want everybody to do, as we're studying this class, I'd like for you to take some time during the week and listen to that CD. Now, it takes about an hour and 15 minutes to listen to the whole thing. That's all. Okay? You don't have to do anything. You can be driving. You know, if you have a CD player in a car, keep it in the car. Whenever you take off and go somewhere, play it. And listen to it. See if you can listen through it one time each week that we're studying. Okay? It's easy to do. And the reason I want you to listen to it is it's so easy in a book like Revelation that is so full of symbols and elements that you wonder about that when you read it, it's really hard to get stuck. And to go, man, what does that mean? Or, man, look at that cross reference. I'm going to go dig on that a while. And the book of Revelation was written to be read as a whole. It was sent as a message. And in fact, the very first verses of the book says, blessed are those who read and those who hear. And so, you know, one, Jesus, who's dictating this to John in the beginning, he promises a blessing to those who read and those who hear. So every time you listen to this, God promises a blessing. That's a good thing. So, and it will help you understand the book if you listen to it and let the words paint pictures in your mind. In fact, when you're not driving, close your eyes and listen to it with your eyes closed and imagine what's being portrayed. Because it's a very visual book. It's got lots of visual imagery, very strong and powerful images. And so I want to take that perspective. Now, I'm going to be following roughly an outline by Stafford North, who is a member of the Brotherhood. He has served as an elder for many years. He's also taught an outstanding class on understanding Revelation and also about premillennialism. We have a DVD series of this class that he taught. I'm not going to do it exactly the same. It's excellent. I've been through it a couple of times. If you want to borrow it, you're welcome to do that. There's also a couple of books. There's one book called Unlocking Revelation, Seven Simple Keys, which is an excellent book that basically follows the lesson that we're going to do today. But there's a lot to cover in the book, and the main reason that we've been studying the visions of God for over a year now is to prepare us for this study. Because the book of Revelation is probably the most debated, most alternately interpreted, right? Everybody's got their own idea what it means. And most disputed book in the whole Bible. And probably one of the books that almost everybody is interested in figuring out. Because it's the last book of the Bible. It's the one that gives us a clear picture of the second coming, the great white throne judgment at the end of the book. It talks about all kinds of worldwide cataclysms that, you know, people be very interested in. What does that all that mean? And it talks a lot about persecution of Christians and victory of God's people. In fact, that's probably, you know, if the message in Daniel was God is in control, the message of Revelation is God's people win. Right? If you want to boil it down to just a few words, but there's lots of stuff in the middle of it. Now, we're going to take an approach here. We got lots of things to look at today, but we're going to look at five views and seven keys. Now, what I'm going to do, the first couple of lessons in the series, We're going to do an overview today. We're going to do a little more of an overview tomorrow as we get into the book. So we'll have a little, not tomorrow, next week, as we get into the book. So we'll look at you know, the time period, how this sits in the whole arc of the story of the Bible, how it relates a little bit in time to, you know, what happened in Ezekiel and Daniel and Zechariah, what we've been studying. And then we'll actually get into the text of the book, and then we'll go through the book chapter by chapter and through. Which sometimes we'll back off and do a little overview so we can get a projection, because they're, you know, chapters 2 and 3 are letters to the seven churches. So you want to talk a little bit about that as a whole, as well as look at individuals. Then there's this book with seven seals, and then in the seven seals there are seven trumpets, and then in the seven trumpets there are seven bowls. You know, and then there's war in heaven, and you know, there's dragons and beasts and harlots and worldwide destruction, and you know, stars falling and angels showing up and bottomless pits and just all kinds of stuff. So we're going to go through the book, you know, as somebody would read it and understand it, but we're also going to be diving in and sometimes diving out. Okay, so there are roughly five views. You categorize the way people interpret the book roughly in five groups. Now, not everybody who would take one of these as their primary understanding of the book agree with everything that I'm going to say, and some of them, you know, are in different places. In fact, there are people in the Lord's church who believe one of each of these. You know, in other words, it's not just, these ideas are not just set on one particular denominational view of what's going on, although some of them have much stronger affinities than others. So the first one is that the book is about primarily the persecution of Christians by Rome and the fall of Rome. The second one is that it's about the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, those are really interesting differences. We'll talk about some of the differences. The third one is it's about the history of the world. This particular view says that, well, let me back up a second. The second one, the destruction of Jerusalem. This perspective takes the view that all the stuff that's going on, the warnings and the disasters and the judgments and everything else, pertain to the destruction of Jerusalem. When did the destruction of Jerusalem occur? What year? You ought to know this by now, 70 AD, right? Especially after Ezekiel, man, and all we went through, and Daniel. You ought to know, 586, the destruction of the temple. And 70 AD, the second destruction of the temple, the destruction of Jerusalem.
There are some that hold to that not only did our revelation take place, but the Lord returned.
Yeah.
Max King
teaches that, yes.
And that even I thought it never affected North Carolina, but a congregation down on the East Coast split because of that.
Yeah. And I mean, these are not minor issues, right? Congregations split over these. Denominations form over interpretations of this book. People's whole spiritual eternity hinge on how wrapped up they get on one interpretation or the other. This is not, wow, I wonder what those chariots were in the fourth chapter of Zechariah. You know, it's not just a puzzle that you want to think about. This, a lot of times, the way you view this book hinges on your entire understanding of the scripture. So it is very important.
Our interpretations can be different, but we cannot have any interpretation that violates any other scripture.
Exactly. And in, you know, as we've learned in all these books, these figurative books about dreams and visions, the most important thing to consider in all of them is what? The C word. Context. Context, context, context. The context when it was written, the context of who it was initially written to, or who was told it, how they would understand it, the context of the times, the context of the scriptures, the whole period of time in the scriptures, of things that the readers would have known about. Like, for instance, if we're talking about the book of Revelation, and it talks about certain things that showed up in Daniel, you know, Daniel's prophecy, certain images, like maybe a leopard and a bear and a lion, then you might go, I expect that John, who was a Jew, who was raised a Jew and studied the book of Daniel, not to mention being an apostle of Christ, probably had read Daniel before. And so it rang a bell. You know, when this said, oh, this beast has, you know, it's part leopard, part lion, and part bear, he'd go, you know, I heard of leopards, lions, and bears before. Where did I go? Oh, yeah, that was in Daniel. So there's context all through it. Now, I said one, there's lots of different opinions of what the book means. Okay, lots of people have put lots of different spins on it. What I want to do is I want to do a quick overview, which we're going to do in about 5 minutes, of the different views. And then I want to look at what the book says about itself. We're going to do this very quickly, because obviously we'd be studying the whole book if we didn't. We're going to say, what are things that are clearly stated by the book itself that we can do? How many of you like doing crossword puzzles? This is a pretty good analogy. My wife loves crossword puzzles. When you do a crossword puzzle, do you start at the first block and you start writing characters and you just keep writing until you're done? Left, right, left, right, left, right, all the way down? Finish? No. You read the first clue, and the first clue says, man, I don't know that one. Let's look at the second clue. And somewhere around the 15th or 16th clue, you go, I got that one. I'll write that one in, right? And what you do is every clue becomes a clue for something else. And it eventually becomes one whole that's all tied together. And that's a lot of the way when, and this is true with these figurative books and dreams and visions we've looked at, is you get a clue and then you find something else that connects to the clue and that helps you understand it. What we're going to look at is a bunch of the places that you can fill in the crossword puzzle of Revelation. And then the places that are still empty, when we get to those, we'll have all of these locked in place and we'll know what to do. So, let's get back to the thing. So, destruction of Jerusalem, that this one says the harlot's Jerusalem, the second beast is Jerusalem, we'll talk about it, and the great destruction, the great city, is Jerusalem. It talks about that being Jerusalem. Of course, the Roman one talks about those things being Rome. There's one primarily about the history of the world. This particular view says that the book talks about the history of the world from the first coming of Christ to the second coming of Christ. So the people who take this view, and there are whole commentaries and many books written about each of these views, okay? So it's not just like one person off in the weeds that has this idea. They're broadly held. At least they were at some period of time. The history of the world perspective believes that the book describes all the different eras and major activities in the eras from the first coming of Christ to the second coming of Christ. So, for instance, it says, yeah, it talks about Rome, but it also talks about the Catholic Church. And it talks about the Reformation movement, John Calvin and Martin Luther. And it talks about wars between nations, like the great wars between France and England. And you know, it paints a picture of all of political and religious history. That's the perspective of this particular one. There's one that's kind of a philosophical view that looks at, it's not about any particular people or particular time, but it's a collection of principles. And you can see those principles happening every time Christ is preached. Whenever Christ is preached, you're going to have persecution, you're going to have God's protection of the church, and you're going to have revenge on the persecutors. And this view oftentimes says that there are 7 cycles in the book of Revelation. About every 2 or 3 chapters covers about a period of about 2,000 years in history, and it talks about, you know, this same pattern. So it's not saying this is just about one thing or just about another. It says it's just a set of general principles that are always going to happen, and they tend to repeat themselves. Okay? Then the last one is the futurist view, and this is the one that everybody hears about all the time. This is the one that talks about, that says that most of the book is still to come in the future, that is predictions of the second coming of Christ and the events that are going to happen around that time period. Very often it's said that we're living roughly in the third chapter of Revelation, and the rest of it is about rapture, thousand-year reign, Armageddon, all those things you hear. The Left Behind series that was so popular in books and movies is all about this. Hal Lindsey's late great planet Earth, and there's a new world coming, and things like that are all about this, okay? There are several major denominational groups. You know, the Baptists tend to hold to this. A number of other ones do. The Pentecostals tend to hold to these things, where they're looking at everything in Revelation, almost everything, as predictions of events that you can identify as signs that the end is coming and the second coming is about to be here. So that's their perspective. Now, we will say some things about these perspectives as we go through the book. But what we're going to do, first of all, is we're going to say, what does the book say about itself and what are the keys to understanding the book? And then after we look at these keys, we're going to go back and say, which of these fit the evidence that's in the book most directly? And then that's the perspective that I'm going to take teaching the class, okay? Because you can take, I mean, and obviously people have written huge books or groups or many, many thousands or even millions of people believe some of these different views. One, it doesn't make them right, because people wrote a lot of books and a lot of people believe it. And two, it doesn't mean that the view that I particularly take is absolutely correct and it's all, you know, what I'm saying is you got to take a perspective when you do a book like this, just like I had to take a perspective when I was doing Ezekiel or Daniel. And so I'm going to tell you what my perspective is and the evidence for it. So there are, and Stafford Dove has this metaphor here of seven keys to the book. And here are the seven keys. The book is largely written in symbols. It's about things that are shortly going to come to pass. It's primarily concerned with comfort for Christians in the face of terrible persecution. And there are some major characters that we have to understand if we're going to understand the interpretation of the book. Three of those characters are the dragon and the first and the second beast. Another one of those major characters is the harlot, who's called Babylon the Great. And then you got to understand what this time period thing's about, because you'll see 1260 days, 42 months, and times the half a time show up, 3.5 years, show up several different times in the book. And what I've done here is I've listed all the references where these are talked about, so you can kind of see what's talked about here. And then the last key is understanding the nature of the kingdom, because kingdom is mentioned several times in the book. Sometimes it's talking about the Lord's kingdom. Sometimes it's talking about the kingdoms of the kings of the time, whatever time it's talking about. So if we understand these seven keys and look at the evidence that these say, then it's going to help us make a good decision here on which ones to look at. So the very first one is, this is a symbolic book. This should not surprise anybody. It's largely written in symbols. The message that you, and of course we've been studying figurative language now, and visions and dreams now for over a year, so we understand that there's lots of things that are written in symbols. Now, when you run across, what's the rule for determining whether something should be considered literally or figuratively? Okay, because this is what you have to decide. Now, for instance, if I said to you, man, it's burning up in here, are you going to call the fire department? Probably not. Right? Probably because at the same time, there's some ladies down here going, I'm freezing to death. Right? And you're not going to call an ambulance. Now, why is that? Because we tend to speak in hyperbole, don't we? Those are hyperboles. They're over-exaggerations to stress a point. And so we do that naturally. We don't have any problem with that, right? Very quickly, nobody says, oh, he's going to die. You know, we just say, oh, yeah. So the thing when you're thinking about symbolic language, and especially figurative language and symbols, is remember this little motion here that I talked about last time? This is something Stafford uses. It's a great example. So everybody put your hands like this. Do your arms like this. It'll help reinforce the point. Okay. First of all, this is what it says. This is what it means. Okay? This is what it says on the surface, but this is what it means. So Jesus says, I am the bread of life. Is he literally a loaf of bread?
No.
Of course not. What does it mean? That he's essential to life, like bread's essential. Right? I am the light of the world. He said, ye are the light of the world. Are we actually photons bouncing around? No. Right? Here's what it says. What does it mean? Now, the book is absolutely chock full of here's what it says. Our job is to figure out what does it mean. Now, sometimes it says it very plainly. We're going to look at those. That's going to be some of our first clues in the crossword. So, the book is largely written in symbols. Why? Why was it written in symbols?
Back then, that symbols is the way people read.
Well, that's true, but there's a reason why it was written in symbols. It's more than just people like to use symbolic language when they write. Yeah.
Because they were persecuted at that time.
Yeah. That's a really good likelihood. Is that the Romans were when John was writing this book, which at least most of the views except the destruction of Jerusalem believe that the book was written in the 90s, in the last decade of the first century, there was already terrible persecution going on, and it was just going to get worse. At that time, Domitian was the emperor. You'd already had three emperors, Vespasian and Titus, who'd already started persecuting. You'd had Nero before that time. You know, the Christians were in world hurt right then. And so anything that was going to be critical of Rome or the emperor or emperor worship or any of those things that were happening at that time would be very dangerous stuff, right? You would get killed for it. If they were willing to chop your head off because you didn't sprinkle a pinch of incense on the fire at the marketplace and say Caesar is Lord, and they did chop people's head off for that, in fact, the book tells us about people whose heads were chopped off, then what do you think they'd do if they Roman soldier came up to you and said, let me see that scroll there, Christian. Pulls that scroll out and says, Rome is the Roman Empire is a tool of the devil, and God is going to destroy him. And all the emperors are tools of the devil, and God's going to destroy them too. How long do you think your head would have stayed on your shoulders?
Not very long.
Now, there's another thing is, Jesus used parables, didn't he? In Luke, it was Luke 8:10, Jesus says, and his disciples came to him and said, why do you talk in parables? And what did he say? To you it is given to know, but to them it is not given to know. That they should see and not understand, and hear and not understand. So God has a reason sometimes for using parables or using figurative language to conceal the message so that only the people he wants to get the message understand it. The rest of the people don't. Jesus even said that.
Under the circumstances, I can really see this. We use code during war, any war.
Yeah.
But it's to let the people... It's to get the message to some people, but in this case, to keep it away from the enemy.
We even use codes in our everyday speech, and I'm not talking about cryptic kind of spy-like codes. We have certain keywords that we can say in our culture that carry a lot of weight if you're in our culture, but don't carry a lot of weight if, say, you were born in China.
Right.
So if we say something about our founding fathers, we're not talking about Mao Zedong or the first emperor of Qi. China, right? We're talking about Jefferson and Washington and those guys. So we use those things all the time. There are metaphors and concepts that are limited to the understanding of a certain group. So it's not that unusual. Now, let's talk about the next one. Shortly. The book says in its very first, let's go look at the book. Revelation chapter 1. Very first verse, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants things which must shortly take place. We ought to listen. Very first word of the verse, and what? Very first verse of the book, and what it is? The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants things which must shortly take place. Now, if somebody handed you a book, and the very first verse said things which must. This is about things which must shortly take place. What would you think? This isn't going to happen for 2,000 years. No. You're going to say, whatever he's talking about, it's going to happen soon. Now, let's look at the third verse. Blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy and keep those things which are written in it, for the time is near, or the time is at hand. Now, who's he talking to? Blessed is he who reads. Anybody who reads it, so from the time the book was available, right? The first people who read it and the first people who heard it, he said, keep those things that are written in it, for the time is at hand. At hand for whom? At hand for people 3,000 years from now? No, at hand for you.
65 of the 66 books are directed to the people present living at that time. Logically, yeah. Why would I think the revelation was different than that?
Yeah, exactly. So, when God, and I tried to look at this the other day, is there any book in the Bible... Any book at all, and Gilbert's kind of already said this, but I'm going to stress it. Is there any book in the Bible that was completely and totally meaningless to the people who first received it? That had no relevance to them at all? No. Even the really wild ones, and we looked at them, right? We looked at all three of the major ones. We looked at Ezekiel, Daniel, and Zechariah. Ezekiel, who was it written to? Who got it first? Ezekiel got it. When? Where was he? He was in captivity after the first invasions of Babylon and during the destruction in 586. What was the message? Part of the message is the people still in Jerusalem. You think you're getting away with it. You're not getting away with it. I'm going to destroy you. Part of it was to the people in captivity. You guys understand this is because of your sin and that I'm going to protect you and I'm going to bring you back. Right? But then there's that whole section of Ezekiel where it talks about this perfect temple. Remember that long, detailed architectural discussion of this idealized Israel where all the land was given up in perfect square units and the temple was this perfect thing. And, you know, that obviously wasn't to them, because he was talking about the future. Then you look at Daniel. Who heard the words of Daniel first? King Nebuchadnezzar, for one, right? Because he had those dreams. And then, you know, Belshazzar, and then Cyrus, right? And Darius, and all those guys. And the messages were to them. This is what's going to happen to you, and what's going to happen some in the future, because he did talk about, you know, the great idol we've talked about many times. And several of the prophecies of Daniel really laid out what was going to happen to the Jewish nation at the time, for as long as the Jewish nation was involved, up to 70 AD. So, let's look at 3 verse 11 for a second. Let's try to run through these, because I really do want to get through this today. Okay, this is in the middle of the letters of seven churches. Jesus says, "Behold, I'm coming quickly. Hold fast what you have, that no one take your crown." Now he's talking to the particular church. You know, he's talking to, let's see, the church of Philadelphia. And he says, "I'm coming quickly. Hang on to what you have." Now that's not, don't worry about it. You know, 100 generations from now, you'll worry about it. It's at hand, right? There's something immediate about it. 22:6, and we'll stay in 22 for a second. 22:6 is at the end of the book. "Then he said to me, 'These words are faithful and true, and the Lord God of the holy prophets sent his angel to show his servants the things which must shortly take place. Behold, I am coming quickly. Blessed is he who keeps the words of the prophecy of this book.'" Now this is the end of the book. So the book starts with, "These things are going to shortly come to pass," and it ends with, "These things are shortly coming to pass." Right? And the last one is verse 10. "And he said to me," talking to John, "'Do not seal the words of the prophecy of this book, for the time is at hand. Let him who is unjust, let him be unjust still. Let him who is filthy, be filthy still. Let him who is righteous, be righteous still. Let him who is holy, be holy still.'" He's saying, it's at hand, quickly, quickly, quickly. So whatever you understand about the book, some of it, at least, and probably the majority of it, has to deal with that time period or the time period shortly thereafter. Not, you know, nothing of this matters for 2,000 years, don't worry about it. Now, there may be elements of the book, and there are, obviously, because the Great White Throne Judgment scene, for instance, is one of them, which is still yet to come. But the people who heard the book, when they were told, quickly, 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 hang on to it, listen now, do what it says now, because the time is at hand now, they were thinking now. Okay? Or at least quite soon. Now, let's look at the next one. Comfort and persecution. We're not going to look at all of these. I'm going to just overview them for time. One person said that the book of Revelation has the blood of Christians on every page. That's an interesting characterization. All of these verses that are mentioned here, and you can see it really runs through the whole book, are things that talk about persecution of Christians. The very first one, verse 1:9, John says, I am in the tribulation with you. He says, there's a time of trouble, it's right now, and we're in it together. Okay, so whatever you want to think about other times of tribulation, John said there was one right now, and we're in the middle of it. Five of the letters of seven churches talk about persecution that they were going through. Antipas, my faithful martyr, was martyred, was killed. A bunch of the persecution that was going on, that was happening. When you get later into the book, you find there are 400 souls, 6:9. 6:9. It says there were hundreds of souls under the throne who had been beheaded because of their testimony. And they cry out to God. This is a very key verse. We're going to spend a lot of time on this verse later. They cry out to God and say, God, how long is it going to be before you avenge our blood? And God says, not yet. Until the rest of your brothers who are going to be killed like you are completed. In other words, terrible persecution, and it's going to continue for a while. God's saying that, right? Now, and you go through this, and what do you see? You see these beasts, you see this great dragon, you see these monsters, and they're persecuting the church. It says the dragon makes war on the church. And it says that the harlot, whoever it is filled with the blood of the saints to the point that she's drunk with it. And when she's destroyed, it says it was found within her the blood of the saints and the blood of prophets. You know, you have at one point, you have rivers of blood in the book talk about. So there's lots of persecution. There's one place where there are two witnesses that are killed and let their bodies are left lay in the street. for 3 days, and then they're taken off to heaven. So there's a ton of persecution in this book. It's talked about all over the place. And everywhere, God is being up front, and he's saying, the persecution's coming, and it's going to be hard. But in every case, I'm going to protect you, and you're going to win anyway. You know, in each of the seven letters, he says, be faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life. Be faithful unto death. He's saying, yeah, a lot of you are going to die. Be faithful unto death. So, that's a major key. Understanding that the book is really focused on persecution is a major key. Now, when we get to the players in the play here, and Revelation, very much the center part of Revelation, is very much like a play. There are these characters that are introduced. They're not directly introduced by name, although one of them is very clearly introduced. And there are these fantastic characters. There's a dragon, great red dragon with seven heads and 10 crowns, 10 horns and crowns on his head. He's got a great tail. It can sweep out a third of the stars from heaven, right? Very fantastical kind of creature. You've got the first beast, which comes up out of the sea, which has a body that's like a leopard and a lion and a bear. And he has 7 heads and horns and crowns, right? And then you have the second beast, which comes up out of the earth, and it says he has horns like a lamb, but he speaks like a dragon. You know, so you have this kind of, you really need to understand who these characters are if you're going to know what it is. Now, the first big crossword puzzle clue is in 12:3. So let's go look at 12:3 here real quick. Because there's one of these critters that nobody can argue anything else but. Because the scripture very plainly says what it is. So, chapter 12, we've got another sign appeared in heaven, verse 3. Behold, a great fiery red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems or crowns on his head. His tail drew a third of the stars and threw them to earth. The dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. She bore a male child. You know, you're looking at this and you're going, okay, that's the dragon. Now skip down to, where am I at? 9. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. So, says dragon, what does it mean? Satan. Plainly stated. Nobody can argue that one. It says, that dragon, who we've been talking about in chapter 12, is the devil and Satan, the serpent of old. It's clear. So we know who that one is. That one's Satan. So we need to write that one up in here. We know that one's Satan. Now we have the other beasts. So these two beasts show up in chapter 13. So let's pop over to chapter 13. And let's take a look. Verse 1. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns. Basically the same number of heads and crowns and whatever as the dragon. And on his head, a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear. His mouth was like the mouth of a lion. The dragon gave him his power, his throne, and his authority. Okay? So, first of all, whose side is this beast on? The dragon side. Uh-oh. Dragon. Says dragon means Satan. First beast is on Satan's side. Very clear. No one has to argue. Right? Okay. What do we know about this beast? He's got parts of different animals. It says, now the beast I saw, verse 2, was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear. His mouth was like the mouth of a lion. Where do those critters show up before in the Bible? We studied them in the book of Daniel. Remember the idol? It talked about the Babylonian Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, the Greek Empire, and the Roman Empire. And then later on in the book, it says the lion is the Babylonian Empire. The bear is the Medo-Persian Empire. Remember the bear that had bones in its mouth and was hitched up on one side? It was an unbalanced kingdom. Then the leopard with 4 wings and 4 heads that runs, that doesn't even touch the ground when it runs, right? Being the Greeks, Alexander the Great in particular, but the leopard represented the Greek Empire. And then the monster, which isn't described, I used a T-Rex as the example, right? A great monster, which stomped all of them to pieces and had 10 horns. So you've got pieces of the Babylonian kingdom, the Medo-Persian kingdom and the Greek kingdom, all wrapped up in this monster who represents this first beast. Okay? From looking at the book of Daniel. So when you look at that, the one other thing we want to look at there is 17. Let's take a look at 17 for a second. 17:9. It says, here is wisdom. He's talking about the beast. In particular, the harlot riding on the beast, he rides on this beast at one point. Here's the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. There are also seven kings. Five have fallen. One is, and the other is not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. Okay. So we're going to have this picture in a minute of the harlot riding this first beast. It says those seven heads have meanings. It has two different meanings. One of them is seven hills on which the woman sits. We'll talk about that when we get to the harlot. The other one is there's seven kings. And then he says, five have fallen. One is, and one is yet to come. And then there's going to be an eighth. He talked about in the next verse. So John is being told this right now in the 90s. Right? Last of the first century. And he says, whatever you're thinking about this beast and these heads, let me tell you. These heads represent kings. Five of them have already gone. One of them is now, when John's writing. And one of them's coming, and there's going to be another one after that. There's going to be an eighth. So whatever you're looking at, this first beast is representing a collection of kings, five of which at the time of the writing were gone. One of them was happening, and one was going to come after. So that really pretty much pegs it in the first century. First and second centuries right there in that time period. But let's go ahead and continue. So, let's look at the second beast. The second beast is talked about in chapter 13. So let's go back to chapter 13, verse 11. Then I saw another beast coming. This is right after the first beast was talked about, right? Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth. So the first one came out of the sea, this one came out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb. So he's kind of like a lamb.